welcome back to the second part of our Boulder Scene event, and we've got more speeches to come. And the next person to speak was ex-BNP, ex-Democratic Nationalist, and now with the British Democrats, okay? Please welcome to the stage, Jim Luthwaite.
Right. First of all, a small party political. We are still campaigning in Bradford South in the White Ward. There are four campaigning days left. We've lost a lot of time the last week due to rain. So anybody that can possibly come across and help us would be enormously welcome. There will be some areas of the ward which won't be covered, and a couple of boxes of leaflets that won't go out unless we get some support. So I'd be very grateful for anybody to come across up to the last minute. If you want to see the leaflets we're putting out, we have a general purpose anti-immigration leaflet, which is suitable for the whole country, if anybody wants any. And we have, obviously, a local candidate leaflet. It is the ward I was formerly councillor for in 2004-07 for the BNP, so we do have a chance. What set me off on thinking about myth-busting was, like the rest of you, I've been subjected to barrages of propaganda about the so-called Windrush scandal, in the course of which I was watching on TV various dusky-hued gentlemen insisting that they were just as British as I was. One said, "I am an Englishman, I have no links with the Caribbean whatsoever, and I hate being deported to it." And the second, of course, was the suggestion that there might be a Stephen Lawrence Day, presumably modelled on Martin Luther King Day. And one immediately thought, hang on a minute, what about the white victims? The Frank Black sport. To my knowledge, there's 400 of them. But if we're going to have a day of remembrance, it should be a day of remembrance for all victims of racial violence, of whom the majority will be white. To actually single out a single black individual and ignore everything else is clearly part of a campaign of white guilt building, which is designed to keep us in a state of cowed state for the next century, feeling guilty that somebody murdered a black teenager, may or may not have murdered a black teenager, because the Met originally worked on the hypothesis that it was something to do with a drugs deal that went wrong. A great deal of the sainthood of Stephen Lawrence has been, of course, artificially built up to build him up as some sort of hero. He may, at the very worst, have been the victim of a single event. But other people have been the victim of campaigns going on for some time. When I was in Keighley, in the BNP campaigning of the early 2000s, I was approached, this is hard to believe, it's true, by Pakistanis who were complaining that the murderers of a white teenager in Oldham, his name deserts me, but I remember it at the time, these Pakistanis came up and said the gangsters that had committed this crime were well known in the neighbourhood, were terrifying the Pakistanis in Keighley, and could the police not do something about it? Since they had approached all the legitimate mainstream parties and nothing had been done, they thought the BNP might be in with a chance. We approached the police and they said it was impossible to prosecute, despite the fact that these gangsters were walking around the streets of Keighley boasting that they had killed a white teenager in Oldham and got away with it. And they still have, because they've never been prosecuted. So perhaps we should bear that in mind when we contemplate Stephen Lawrence Day. So the two myths which had occurred to me need to be busted. The point is they can't be busted by an individual party. They can't be busted by the British Democrats or any other single group saying we protest about this. The only thing which will have any impact, if anything can have any impact on the establishment, will be a broad front nationalist grouping bringing together as many people as possible, and if possible, bringing in the more decent elements from mainstream parties like UKIP and so on, because these are issues which are too big for any one party to address. And it would be too easy for the establishment to crush any protest if we were to write to the Home Secretary and say, we want a Memorial Day for all victims of racial violence. You can imagine what the press would do with it if it were just a single party, a single individual, something like Britain First or the National Front, whatever. It would be dismissed so easily and smeared. So it has to be a broad grouping and, as far as possible, incorporate people who are beyond smearing. Anyway, the two myths which I think we need to address are myths which are being implanted in our minds, and especially in the minds of school children, and we have to combat them before they become established as the received truth, as real history. The first one is, what was World War II fought about? And the second is the mass immigration of the 50s onwards from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent. Was it, as I was surprised, like probably many of you, to learn, was it because they were invited here to build up the country? I don't remember hearing anything about that in the 60s and 70s when immigration was going on. Surely, if you have a rhetorical trope of such power that they were invited here and doing us a huge favour and we should be eternally grateful, that would have been deployed when it was most useful, when the immigration was going on. And yet I have never heard that argument put forward until very recently. And in this context, where a government is trying to excuse what it did, as many speakers have said, without any permission from the British people, 50 years after the event, when hopefully many of the witnesses will be dead, and therefore unable to contradict this. I merely offer this as a hypothesis. But I think it takes a broad front nationalist response to these two myths before they become established as truth. Now, why did we fight World War II? Well, when I was a kid, and I'm not just talking about war picture library or commandos sort of paperbacks, I'm talking about standard history books. There was a war between Britain and France and Germany, to begin with, over the issue of the Danzig Corridor, but there was a bigger principle behind that. It was one going back at least two centuries, probably three. It was the balance of power in Europe, which was why it formed a continuity with World War I, which was the eternal German question of Germany trying to establish hegemony in Europe and an alliance of nations forming against it. In other words, it was all about restoring the equilibrium of power between the various nation states of Europe into what might be called a fair manner. But that's not what's being taught today, and there is a reason behind that. It is now being presented as our equivalent of the Soviet Great Patriotic War, a war unlike any other, just as the Holocaust, we are told, was an event unlike any other, though Armenians and other people who've been the victims of genocide might, of course, point out it wasn't the first any such event, and that I can think of Chinese annals going back to 2000, where the Chinese emperor said, are the UAG still a problem on the northwest frontier? Yes, Your Majesty, right. Well, exterminate them, down to the last man and woman. So it's as old as human history. But I digress. The story we are being presented with is that World War II was an exception. It was a war against racism and fascism. It was a war against isms. Now, when George Bush declared a war on terror, he was told you can't declare a war on an abstract noun. It's unwinnable because it's an abstract principle. So, World War II, the war against racism and fascism. Curiously, there's no mention of a war against racism and fascism in Stanley Baldwin's proclamation of war. He says that we have given certain undertakings to the Poles, rightly or wrongly, and these undertakings have been destroyed by the British, by the German invasion of Poland. They have been told to withdraw. They have not withdrawn. Therefore, Britain will go to war. Nothing about regime change in Germany. Nothing about fighting abstract nouns. Nothing about racism or fascism. And in the name of, the British Empire. Now, my mother lived through the Second World War. She was a schoolteacher in Scotland Road, Liverpool, and evacuated to North Wales. My father volunteered in 1938 to join the Border Regiment. We're a Cumbrian family. He fought in France. He missed Dunkirk, like many British troops. He was too far south to go out through Dunkirk. So he came out much later, through Cherbourg, on the ship after the Lancastrian, the greatest maritime disaster in British history. More than 4,000 people killed when it was dive-bombed in Brest Harbour. So he was very lucky to get out. He was then posted to the Western Desert and fought with 5th Indian. He'd been transferred to the Jutt Regiment by then. And he fought at Gryzat Ridge in 1st Alamein, and then was passed on to Burma, and fought on after World War II, because, little known fact, after the British Indian troops thought they were going home on VJ Day, they were told, no, you're not, you're going to Indonesia to help recapture Java for the Dutch. At which point, slight digression, the Japanese Army of Occupation of Indonesia became our allies, and the Indonesian guerrillas, who had previously been our allies, became our enemies. Something which politicians could easily understand, but simple-minded soldiers obviously found a little bit difficult to understand why their former enemies were now being fed British Army rice, and they were told to cooperate with them in crushing the people who'd previously been fighting with us. But this brings us on to the wider question of the whole of World War II. When I spoke to my mother and father about the war, they said they were fighting for God, King, country, and empire. Now, you won't find that in a modern history book. We were fighting to defend the British Empire. Not so much obvious in the Western War, because Hitler was a firm supporter. Read Mein Kampf, and he emphasized the British Empire as one of the foundations of the structure of the world. The last thing he wanted to do was destroy the British Empire. Mm-hmm. With Japan in the East, of course, it's the absolute opposite. They intended to invade the Dutch East Indies and Malaya and Burma and seize the oil, the tin, the rubber, the assets which they lacked entirely in Japan, and take them off us. And when we fought the Japanese, it's absolutely crystal clear that we're fighting in defence of the British Empire. So this is not what you're going to be taught in the history books of the future. And I have no doubt whatsoever that the establishment are hoping that when the last person dies who can remember what they actually fought for, then they will have nobody to deny that it was a war against racism and fascism, and can therefore be used to beat everybody over the head with who is a self-proclaimed racial nationalist. They will repeat to you endlessly, we fought wars against people like you, so how dare you suggest an idea which has not only outlived its time, but is utterly obnoxious. It will be forgotten that when Britain supposedly stood alone, it wasn't alone, because it had a quarter of the world's population behind it. We have the Australians, the Canadians, the New Zealanders, the South Africans, the Rhodesians. 2.5 million people volunteered on the Indian subcontinent to the biggest volunteer army in the history of the world. Well, they wouldn't have done that if they'd been badly treated. The British rule in India could have been overthrown any time if the Indians had wanted to. But remember that India, with a capital I, is a creation of Europeans, because before we arrived, there were just a lot of Maharajas fighting each other. Indian nationalists could not be Indian nationalists without the idea of nationalism, alien to the Indian subcontinent, being implanted in their minds, because it is a Western concept, not an Indian concept. So a lot of the textbooks are simply repeating lies, but more importantly, they are ideologically driven to make us think in a way which is different from the way we do think and the way in which we ought to think. On a sidetrack, but an important one, I'd like to ask the audience a question. Whose fuel filled the tanks of the Messerschmitts over Kent in 1940? or Guderian's tanks driving for the coast before Dunkirk. There had been an economic blockade of Germany since the declaration of war, so no oil was getting in from outside Europe. Germany has very few oil wells.
Lost
a few. You're probably going to say, oh, it's the Romanian oil from Ploiești, but the big deal with Romania only occurred after the fall of France. Well, American. It was from Joe Stalin.
Joe Stalin
was Adolf's best buddy at the time. The fuel in the tanks and the airplanes came from Maikop, Grozny, Baku, as part of the big deal agreed in the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Oh, yeah, cool.
In return for German finished goods, including a semi-completed cruiser and various other things, the Russians supplied Germany with things it was short of. Grain. Oil. It also passed on rubber and tin from Malaya and Burma, bought through third parties like the Japanese and so on, and transshipped the length and breadth of Russia, because Stalin was very anxious to keep Adolf happy. At the same time, the British and French Communist parties were agitating, creating strikes, causing sabotage, and urging the workers of the world to fight against the Western plutocrats, like Churchill, and join the common workers' struggle of Uncle Adolf and Uncle Joe, who were best buddies, as I repeat at this time, and carving up Europe between them. Remember, there wouldn't have been a Second World War if Hitler hadn't been confident that he had a deal with Stalin. And Stalin was looking forward to the Western powers and Germany grinding each other into dust over 4 years of trench warfare, because nobody, even the German generals by and large, did not expect the victory, the Sichelschnitt of 1940. That came as a surprise to everybody. Stalin and other people calculated that there would be a long, hard struggle which would reduce both the Western powers and Germany to a state when he could move in and take over. But you won't be taught that in the history books. So we have every reason to stand up and say, as a nationalist movement, that we want the real version of the facts to be presented. Remember again that America only joined the war because of the Japanese struggle. There could have been two separate wars. It's only the accident that Hitler declared war on America on December the 11th, that the two wars came together. The Americans were by no means rushing to our aid, and there was a very strong isolationist lobby. If Yamamoto hadn't made the mistake of attacking the Americans at Pearl Harbor, which he didn't need to do to secure the assets he wanted in the Dutch East Indies, Malaya and Burma, the Americans might never have entered the war, even against Japan. And they certainly wouldn't have declared war on Germany if Hitler hadn't declared war on them. But you won't get that in the history books, because of course we have a special relationship. Except it wasn't very special when the Americans were basically selling us everything in exchange for long-term credits, which they cashed in on. I think we paid off the last of the American deals only very recently. And a final point, if you read John Keegan's Six Armies in Normandy, which I urge you to do, he points out that the British and the American troops in Normandy in 1944, by and large, didn't really know what they were fighting for. There are questionnaires. There are evidence on morale, saying quite clearly, nobody really knew after the original crisis of the so-called invasion of Britain, which could never have occurred because Germany didn't have the maritime assets to launch an invasion. I mean, the myth of the Battle of Britain served its purpose, but Churchill knew at the time, because he was sending all the military assets he possibly could to the Western Desert, so he clearly wasn't expecting an invasion either. It was a useful myth to focus the attention of the British people on their survival, that there was a threat to their survival, but there actually wasn't. So the Battle of Britain was largely a myth because the Germans would never have got past the Royal Navy. But the final point I want to make is, notice how these days you just don't read about the German army, it's the Nazi army. Now, not everybody in the German army was a Nazi, and most of them, if asked, would say, I'm fighting for Germany. but an awful lot of ex-communists, ex-social democrats, ex-conservatives, ex-everything else. There were huge plots in the German army against Hitler from start to finish. The idea that we were fighting Nazism is a modern myth which is being created for ideological purposes to get the idea of nationalism firmly put into the bad boys' corner. That's the first myth. The second one is obviously the question of mass immigration from the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent. As I say, I never heard this argument about they came here to rebuild Britain. I do recall a documentary in which a lot of people from the Windrush said that they'd come to Brixton because there was mass unemployment in the West Indies. There was a collapse of the local economy. I mean, you can only export so many bananas, so much rum, etc. And there was a local crisis. They came to Britain looking for work. They went from labour exchange to labour exchange in South London looking for work. Well, does that sound like a government scheme to introduce workers which we sorely needed? It doesn't to me. I don't know if it does to you, but I suspect this idea they're invited in to rebuild the country is a very modern myth. And it has to be challenged before it becomes established. The whole point is that you can look at what happened there in terms of push and in terms of pull. You can ask what pulled people in here, and you can ask what pushed them out of their homelands. Now, what pulled them in here? We're being told that it was to rebuild the country. Well, all I can say is that when I was around as a school kid, I didn't see many Pakistanis working on building sites. What they were employed in, by and large, was poorly paid night shift work in mills, or in public corporations. They worked for something like the Birmingham Corporation bus service, or above all the railways. In other words, they worked in sectors of the economy which were exceptionally, even by British standards in the 50s and 60s, poorly paid and bad conditions. And I think there's a much simpler explanation. They were hired as the cheapest possible labour to do the most unpopular jobs. But that's not the same as being invited in to rebuild the country. That's saying that they found a niche doing jobs which other people were not prepared to do. I do know from people in Bradford that I've spoken to, going back to that era, that there was never a problem getting people to do night shifts in mills, providing they were paid a reasonable rate. But the mill owners did not want to pay a decent rate. So they were quite happy to scour the four corners of the globe to get cheapest labour possible. Yeah. But that's not the same as inviting people in to rebuild the country. That's saying we are utterly unscrupulous, ruthless, grad-grind employers, and we will find anybody who will live 15 to a house and do a night shift because we won't pay a decent rate. In other words, there was a possible alternative future for Britain in the 1950s, one in which working class people would have risen through simply the inexorable laws of supply and demand. Their labour would have been in demand, there might not have been enough supply, therefore wages would have risen, but that would have given them money to spend on goods and services and thereby raised the economy generally. It's a different track to the one which has been practiced, but just imagine what a different Britain we could be living in if ordinary working class people could have something like lower middle class jobs and the spending to go with it, and their kids could have the education that would follow from that and the rest of it. We could have had a very different last 50 years if instead of going down the route of mass immigration of cheap unskilled labour, which then hangs around even when the last mill has shut down and is going to be a permanent burden on the future, to what has happened. The other side of it is, of course, the push argument, and you'll never hear this in the textbooks. By push, I mean that what we've actually had is the people who wanted to leave their homelands the most, not the ones that we needed the most. We've had the worst of the world's people, not the best. If we'd sat down and planned our future, we'd have said, right, we want highly educated people, preferably white, preferably Christian, so that they can be assimilated relatively easily. But that's not what we've got. If you open your doors wide and say, we'll take anything, and there are people out there living in civil wars, living in conditions of absolute poverty, you get them because they need to get out of their situation the most, and they land on your doorstep. And then, as one of the previous speakers said, you have the problem that at the same time, you start attributing housing to need rather than contribution. And I refer you to the well-known book on the East End by Dench, another left-wing, old Labour sociologist, emphasising the East End has been completely devastated by the implementation of that policy of need, not contribution. Because obviously a starving refugee who turns up from a third world with a shirt on his back and 15 kids, his need is greater than yours. Even if you've paid into the system and paid your taxes and done your duty by your fellow citizen for 25 years, you're at the back of the queue because your needs are not as strong as his are. Your contributions might be infinite and his negligible, but the system has been changed. It's none of these rules, like the one which Theresa May and Amber Rudd are now being criticised for. It's a bureaucratic stroke of the pen which has had untold implications for future generations. But nobody voted for it. Nobody's even asked if they wanted to contemplate it, but it is now the norm. So as long as starving refugees turn up from third world countries, bringing with them their ancestral and ethnic hatreds, then we have to house them, even if it means pushing our own people back. And just to remind people of what they're escaping, the partition massacre is supposed to of August 47 onwards. I was born shortly thereafter I should have been born in East Pakistan, but all the hospitals had gone to pieces by then, so I was actually flown on board to Calcutta to be born. Minor story, but indicative of the conditions in which the West Pakistanis were treating East Pakistan. Basically, all the money went to build Islamabad, so there weren't any hospitals in East Pakistan to be born, if you follow me. And of course, in the Bangladeshi, the Bengali uprising, 1971, would anybody hesitate to guess how many people were killed? Well, 3 million. Most of them, Bengali citizens massacred by the Pakistani army or its surrogates, by militia gangs operating on behalf of the Pakistanis. One was hanged recently in Dhaka after long, long years of seeking him down and prosecuting him. But remember that people are arriving from the third world, not just from the subcontinent, but other countries. There was a civil war. I asked Peter Rushton if he could remember the exact details, but other people can doubtless look it up on their computers. There was a civil war in Guyana and Trinidad between East Indians and West Indians, because basically, if you think about their sociology, they're completely different. Apart from their racial differences, their societies are incompatible. But there was a civil war in the 70s between West and East Indians. We're all familiar, no doubt, with the trouble in Fiji, which has gone on for centuries, ever since the British brought Indian labourers in to work there. There's been trouble between the Fijians and the Neo-Melanesians, or the Neo-Fijians, or Indians, who were brought in to grow sugarcane, which the Fijians were not prepared to do. And there was a little-known civil war in Natal, South Africa, in the late 40s between Zulus and Indians, again. But you won't read about any of this. It's all sanitised in the textbooks, because it doesn't suit the case that racial antipathies are exclusively between black and white and are the fault of the whites. The fact of the matter is that different ethnic groups have been fighting each other ever since humanity began. And now that we know more about the fact that at one stage there were six different sorts of humanoids wandering around the globe at about 300,000 BC, and there's only one now, it's pretty reasonable to suppose that human beings have been wiping each other out on an ethnic basis for quite a long time. So my conclusion would be, let's fight these myths before they become accepted as the received wisdom by generations of school children who couldn't possibly challenge them on factual grounds by saying, my daddy says it wasn't like that at all, because they just won't be listened to. If we don't do it, nobody else will. But if we're going to do it, we have to do it as an organised broad church movement. We cannot do it as individual parties sticking it in their election leaflets and hoping to get electoral advantage. We must do it as a national movement. Thank you.
Yes, of course.
Would you like to answer some questions?
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yes. Jim Luthwaite, everybody, give him a clap.
Going back to the first myth on the Second World War, has anybody ever come up with a reason why France and Britain had a non-aggression pact with Poland, guaranteeing then they were attacked, they would both come in and defend Poland?
Which we were not in the position to do.
Mm. Soviet Union. We never declared war.
Just the cynical judgment by Churchill that he would do a pact with the devil if it would
at
do down
Hitler.
At the
time was it brought up?
It's never been explained the logic. The Molotov-Ribbentrop pact was absolutely essential for the Second World War to have happened at all, because if Hitler thought that there was any danger of having to fight Stalin at the same time as the Western Allies, he wouldn't have gone to war. Remember, he turned to Ribbentrop and said, what the hell are we going to do now? Because he wasn't expecting a declaration of war from Britain and France. For us to extend a promise to the Poles, which we had no intention of ever keeping, it was assumed that the promise of an alliance in itself would scare the Germans off, except it didn't. So neither the British nor the French did anything during the phony war to defend the Poles, or indeed to do anything else. They just basically sat in their trenches.
But
logically, when the Russians moved in under their part of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact on September 17th, we should have declared war on Russia. Remember that we were very close to coming close to having a war with Russia over the, again, a completely forgotten Russo-Finnish War of November 2 March. Now, when Churchill cynically decided to invade Norway in order to seize the iron ore resources around Narvik and prevent the Germans, if you remember, the whole point was that iron ore during the winter had to come down the coast of Norway from the North Swedish iron ore mines. The only way to get it through the down to Germany, because the Swedes sold not only iron ore, but both as guns to the Germans with Geir Bandon, like the Swiss sold them bowl ball bearings. I mean, you know, money's money. They could only get iron ore to Germany by sending it across the mountains to Narvik and then down the coast. So Churchill decided to invade Norway in 1940, using as a cover the contribution to be made to the Russo-Finnish War. We were supposedly going to send troops to Finland to help them fight off the Russian bear. The 5th Scots Guards were embarked on a cruiser squadron, which was meant to be sent to Norway and then take over the ports and the airfields. That was abandoned, ironically, when German intelligence found out we were going to do this and launched a preemptive strike. But the history books obviously say that Hitler launched an unprovoked assault on Norway and Denmark. Well, it wasn't unprovoked. German intelligence had broken our codes and realised that we were going to stop them getting the iron ore from Sweden. So they went to war, as far as they were concerned, for a perfectly legitimate purpose. Even at that stage, we could, if those troops had actually landed in Finland. And I have met volunteers who fought at the Russo-Finnish War on the Finnish side. British volunteers, a chap from Cornwall, who told me at length about his going to Finland to fight for the Finns. But it was hugely popular in the US. There was enormous support for supporting Finland. Ironically, people who did not support Finland were the Norwegians and Swedes, who were too scared that Stalin would invade them if they did anything. And again, Stalin's invasion of the Baltic countries Bradford is still full of Estonian and Latvian and to a certain extent Lithuanian refugees who got out when Stalin again decapitated Baltic society. I mean, not only the Polish officers and teachers and intellectuals were shot at Katyn and the other two places in 1940, but the entire intelligentsia of the Baltic countries were either shipped off to Siberia or shot on the spot to decapitate Baltic society permanently, and Russian citizens were drafted in to keep the Balts down forever. That's why 50% of modern Latvians and Estonians aren't Estonians or Latvians at all, they're Russians. And they're there so that Putin can invade someday and say that they're being oppressed. So yes, there's a huge hidden question here, but again, you won't see that question asked in the textbooks. If we were justified in declaring war on Germany, then surely we should have declared war on Stalin. And there were some conservative MPs, one got himself sacked from a ministry by saying that he sincerely hoped that Hitler and Stalin would batter each other into a state of total dormancy and thereby cease to be a problem for the rest of the globe thereafter. And he was sacked because he'd spoken out of turn. The official line was Stalin is now a good guy, Uncle Joe. All the Soviet propaganda films of the period emphasise what a nice chap this mass murderer was. But remember that all his mass murder occurred before the war and was well known about it. So when Churchill made that decision that Stalin was a worthwhile ally, it wasn't because of ignorance. It wasn't because he didn't know the Ukrainian Holodomor, the 7 million dead. It wasn't because he didn't know about the Russian Civil War. It wasn't that he didn't know the old Bolsheviks were a Talmudic conspiracy, because he himself had campaigned in the 20s precisely against Bolshevism. So he set all that aside in favour of a tactical alliance. But one thing you'll not see repeated, remember that everybody goes on about the Iron Curtain descending on Europe, his speech at Fulton, Missouri, but I've read countless German textbooks, but not one single English language textbook, which points out that he also said at the end of the war, we have slaughtered the wrong pig. He realised by 1945 that he might have got it wrong, that he backed the wrong person, and a more judicious thing to do would be to have let Hitler and Stalin fight each other to a standstill and then exploited the resultant deadlock, which is of course exactly what Stalin was hoping to do. And in support of that, remember that we wouldn't have lost Singapore if the Hurricanes, which could have defended it, had not been sent to Russia. The tanks and aircraft which we needed to defend the East were sent to Russia instead, because Churchill regarded looking after Stalin as a greater priority than defending Malaya and Burma. He'd written them off. Any other questions?
Basically, Winston Churchill would not was bankrupt and drunk, and he was and his home was on the market.
Bailed out by Merchants.
And then the focus group, you know, really Zionist organization, they bailed him out, and basically he built his war on warmongering. He built his career as a warmonger to destroy Hitler and pay his backers. But that's basically why what the contradiction is.
Well, he was
the guarantee given to Poland was just a pretext in order to get this war going, because that war being declared the day Hitler got elected.
Well, yeah. That's the 1934 business by Bronfman or whatever it is. But another point is, you can understand appeasement better if you see it not as appeasement, but as the balance of power. Many textbooks will point out that British troops coming back from the Western Front at the end of the First World War had grown to become very respectful of their German opponents. There was, by and large, a great deal of respect for the German army and German people. They just felt they were sort of good, tough people like ourselves. There was universal contempt for the French. A lot of appeasement was due to British Tories in particular thinking that the behaviour of the French in the Rhineland and so on was so barbaric that it was time to readjust the balance, that letting the French run rampant wasn't the balance of power in Europe. There had to be some redressing of the balance between France and Germany. It had gone too far in the direction of the French. Clemenceau, if you remember, was all in favour of destroying Germany as a nation and breaking it into pieces. His famous quote, "I love Germany so much, I'd like there to be several of them."
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that there's that, but behind that was the Communist agenda.
Well, again, you won't read about that history.
Like today, we're attacking Syria because he's got a chemical weapons attack when Israel has used chemical weapons against the Palestinians.
Well, these things, as I say, are all in the mainstream media, but we all know how much we believe that. It's very instructive to watch Russia Today. I know it's another propaganda channel, but it's a different propaganda channel. I was astonished to see a Russia Today programme a year or two ago on massacres by the Turkish army and police in Turkish Kurdistan, specifically the city of Cizre. If you remember, there was a lot of film coming out on Channel 4 and Sky News and the BBC about the destruction of Aleppo. We've seen pictures of Aleppo bombed into ruins and starving refugees and kids in hospitals and all the rest of it. Well, this was a programme from Russia Today with an English language correspondent with an English name. You know, many of the Russia Today correspondents are English or American. And it's from Cizre in Kurdistan. And it was a similar landscape. The place had been bombed flat, and the person interviewed somebody who'd said 150 people were executed with flamethrowers by the Turkish army in that cellar there. You can still see the sort of smouldering bones. But there wasn't a word of that in the mainstream media. Not a newspaper, not a TV programme, nothing was happening in Turkish Kurdistan, because of course the Turks are technically our NATO allies, and therefore what they get up to against the hapless Kurds is none of our business. But that's a whole item we could discuss one day, is why are the Kurds the biggest people without a country? If we believe in nationalism, then we should say that 40-odd million Kurds shouldn't be distributed across five countries as minorities which are oppressed in each of them. Don't they deserve a country of their own? Yeah, but you won't see it happen soon, yeah, because there's too many vested interests.
But we've got to fight wars in our own national interest. This is the problem. And that Second World War was not in our national interest. We allied ourselves with Russia against Germany, which Germany was favourable to the British Empire.
Yes.
When Russia wanted to destroy the British Empire. Yeah.
And the only other people,
and the Israelis wanted to dominate
the only people
everybody.
Who wanted to destroy the British Empire more than Stalin were the Americans. Because the whole point was that they extracted gold and concessions, ultimately the independence of India. Remember, Churchill said, "I wasn't made Prime Minister of Great Britain, the British Empire, to give India away," but that's what he was forced to do. We gave up India in 1947, and it seems incredible bloodshed long before the Indians were really ready for it, because the Americans put pressure on us. And as for the State of Israel, again, neither Attlee nor Bevin wanted the State of Israel created, but Harry S. Truman put an arm lock on them and said, "You will concede or I'll call in all the debts you owe me, and I will collapse the pound, end of," which is what of course Eisenhower did over Suez. Our so-called greatest allies are only our greatest allies when they need us, not when we need them. That's what Enoch Powell said repeatedly. Don't trust the Americans too much. But again, we'd have to rewrite all the textbooks, you see. It'd be a very expensive exercise.
Jim, one more question, please. Mike Coleman from Stoke-on-Trent.
Jim, just quickly, what's the chances are we getting to write a book about these matters, to, in a way of busting these...
I suspect there are people... I'm not a professionally trained historian.
I know.
I'm aware of things, but there are probably people out there who are better historians who could do the proper research and record it accurately. But what we must do is, if you like, create a market, because, let's face it, if that chap wrote that book and went to any mainstream publisher, they'd just say, "Get lost, we're not printing this book, it's dynamite."
Could I say that...
We've got to be able to guarantee that we could do a contributor, you know, a crowdfunded exercise, so that book would sell, and so the author would get his investment back.
David Irving said this. I mean, he's written the book Churchill's War. He's got all this sort of information collated quite well, and he's very punctilious about the way he...
It's a great researcher, I think.
So I think the answer to that question is...
It's already been
David Irving.
But they've successfully smeared him with the Lippstadt.
Yes, but that's
the only people who would buy it are people who aren't taken in by the mainstream media, who are probably in this hall now, or are people like-minded like us. but the ordinary docile public will believe what they're told to believe.
And there was one final thing about American policy. When we talk about American policy, we're really talking about Manly Peale, Henry Kissinger or Henry Morgan.
Well, we're talking about Tel Aviv politics.
Yeah, that's it.
Because we all know who pulls the strings.
Yeah. And now it's George Soros and
gentlemen, thank you, everybody.
Okay.